we'll get everything straight in the way here. Okay. Oh, yes. There's a thing there with the moon out there. It's all righty. I got this letter. It says, Shepherd? Oh, actually, the guy was from the Bronx. I'm sorry. I was using the wrong accent. Shepherd? You are a living example of a decadent society. So there. Who you think you are? Sign the next listener. Rotten person. That's so, you know, and I felt so good. Have you, way down there, Hope's in there. I felt so good when he said that, that it made me feel wonderful. I really don't think that I've had a nicer thing said about me for a long time. Somehow, to be called decadent is to be called something that most of us rarely ever achieve. I can see myself sitting there with black glasses and sort of fat with somebody throwing grapes in my mouth. And I have this violin, see, and all the while, off in the distance there, there is a fire going. And I'm starting to play. And somehow, Shepard, you're decadent! That's a great thing, I like that. It's true, I mean, I'll first admit it. I don't know whether I'm so decadent. I think I'm more rotten. No, seriously, because you see, the term decadent itself implies falling from a grand state to a lowly estate, to decay. Well, now, I don't know whether I have made that progress. I suspect more that I'm just more like rotten. I think it's closer to the truth. Well, now speaking of the rottenness, it's one of those nights out. Have you looked out? Did you look out tonight? Earlier in the evening. Did you see that unbelievable twilight tonight? It was a scary kind, you know. It makes you feel good in spite of the fact when you listen to the news, you know you should feel rotten. And there it is out there, see. So all the while, I'm beginning to look. I mean, look at that sun out there, and I'm looking at that thing going down. I'm feeling decadent as hell, you know. I'm walking around, and I'm eating grapes and wearing the black glasses. And, yeah, it's too bad. I tried to smoke a cigar once while I was doing the show, but the show came out in fits and starts and burps. And it was a pretty sickening show. I know a guy who can smoke cigars and eat hamburgers at the same time without taking the cigar out of his mouth. I knew one guy who took showers with cigars in his mouth. Seriously, I knew a guy who swims with a cigar in his mouth. Same guy. It's true. Now, speaking of decadence, you know, as long as we're on the subject of that, I walk into the studio here, you know, there's no more in a scapulated world than the world of radio. You are aware of that almost all of us live almost completely surrounded by air conditioning of one kind or another in this world. Well, the first thing I do, I walk in here, and Ed says to me, "Oh, it's too doggone hot." Well, the air conditioning is blowing down his back. One is blowing him in the face. You know, the whole place here, it's roughly, I'd say, 62 degrees in here. But with Ed, it's an abstract heat that he's concerned about. Not himself, it's just he knows it's too hot somewhere. And that's enough. Well, this is in a sense a little thumbnail description of our world. We want to control all of nature. In fact, I think man today is bugged primarily because, you know, nature is out there. And you just can't control it. I mean, you just can't. I mean, seriously, I suspect that the day will come when twilights will be produced here in New York in an other civilized cap. Now, by produced, I mean they will have some kind of gigantic system for having the right mood music playing everywhere behind it, the twilight. And, oh, yes, oh, that's possible, sure. And now, a lot of times, the sun doesn't give you the right kind of light to have a beautiful twilight. What are you going to do? Well, you get Gene Rosenthal. And there will be proper methods of lighting the proper kind of sunsets. And in fact, in the end, I really seriously expect our days to be produced, like big theater productions, you know, gigantic theater productions. There will be a rain. There will be a day of rain. And there will be music accompanying it, suitable music, real wild, turbulent nature music by Dmitri Tiomkin. And it'll be properly controlled rain. It won't be too cold or too hot, and it'll be rain. Oh, yeah, that we will be finally at the point where we really want to be, because we want to control it all the way up and down the line. We have We have tonight's note that in a way actually produces the proof for that. It, you know, we think that it's only in America that this nuttiness is going on. Well, here's one out of Johannesburg, which is South Africa. Well, that's a country that's got a lot of nuttiness in a lot of ways, too. That, there's a lot of nuttiness going on in South Africa. But among other nuttinesses, here's one from South Africa. Have you ever talked to a South African? They sound almost exactly the way you think all Englishmen should sound, but don't. They have a beautiful English accent. Scientists in this country want to learn to talk to lions and birds. This is the note from South Africa tonight. Dr. Nico van der Wery, a Pretoria nationalist, is heading up a project. It's funny how even in the world of science, the Madison Avenue ease is creeping in. He's heading up a project. I suppose Albert Einstein headed up a project to discover what the nucleus of the atom was like. The project, of course, going on in his own skull. But he headed it up, certainly. Each man is his own committee. He's not an island at all in the actual sense of the word. Dr. Van der Wey here hopes to get some ideas about controlling the king of beasts in its preserves by learning to speak to him. Dr. Clem Hager of Potchefstroom is doing the bird talk work at the request of airports and others. "We haven't been asked," he said. If we can't help them talk birds out of cluttering up the airlines, if we only knew more about bird language, we could probably do just that. So I'm going to learn to talk to the birds and just say, "Stay away, will you fellows? You're getting in the way of the jets here." Well, now, that's I kind of like that way. I don't know what... This is likely to be very dangerous because, you see, we assume that we're going to only talk to the birds. It is a two-way thing once you learn to talk. And there's no question about what, you know, a bird watcher thinks birds are all beautiful. Well, what, it's a terrible thing to know, you know, you're liable to be out there, a real good bird watcher out in Central Park, a little thin lady, you know, that lives on yeast. And, you know, a real Peggy fan, and she lives on yeast and cats and little things like that. And she's out there, she's just taken a lot of lessons in, say, wren. Which is a very special kind of a sweet bird talk. You know, wrens are sweet little birds. And she's out there, and she gets close to a wren's nest, and, you know, she goes, "Tweet, tweet," meaning hello, wren. And the wren looks down, and he says this thing. Looks her right in the eye, and he says this awful thing in wren. Well, now, I don't know whether she could blame it on a decadent society or on just wrens themselves. Be careful, friends. Be very careful. Nature has a way of talking back once you learn the language. Now, I don't know whether or not it would be a good idea either to learn the language of lions. But then, on the other hand, you might find that might have some interesting attitudes. You know, it would be intriguing. You know, speaking of man and his relationship to nature, America rarely concerns itself over that. Other nations do quite often because they live in a way closer to it. America, I say, is ahead of all the other nations in its ability to forget that it's out there. Oh, yes. Even when you're living in the middle of nature, you somehow can contrive to control it, manicure it, and put it into a shape where it's very unobtrusive. And we can see this especially in our own lives, in things that relate to ourselves rather than to, say, birds or trees or lakes or wind or sand or stars. Here's a great ad out of one of the Sunday papers. It's a good example of it. Great ad. It comes in four colors, see? And it shows this establishment. Do you see it, Eddie, there? It looks like a cross between Lincoln Center, and it looks a little like a motel, which I kind of like. It has a motel quality to it. Looks a little like a motel, a little like Lincoln Center, and maybe even a little bit like a drive-in hamburger joint. And, you know, it looks kind of nice, like you can leave anytime you want. It's nice and airy, see? And it says, now you can have the ultimate in above-ground burial protection for your family at reasonable cost in the new garden mausoleum. And there it is. It's a kind of a cross between a drive-in bank, and there's a little touch, as we said, there's a little touch of Corvettes there. I'm sure that there is music playing all the time on the grounds for your own entertainment while you're staying there, of course. But the most significant line in the whole ad is, here is the strongest protection possible against nature's forces The strongest protection possible against nature's forces. The finest granite, steel, and reinforced concrete combined in magnificent building designed to endure throughout the ages. Yes, it is the strongest possible protection against nature's forces. That's a terrible thing to say to a guy who's just died. I mean, obviously the protection against nature's forces didn't go quite far enough. Well, one thing you can say to yourself, it may be ashes to ashes, dust to dust for everybody else, but for Charlie Simpson, it's going to be forever and forever and forever and forever and forever and forever. Yes, Charlie will go on marching above ground, eternally marching, or at least laying there, forever, forever, on and on and on. Oh, Johnny Farago. Oh, I can't. I think your rabbit's with us tonight. Oh. Oh, I want a bunny for Christmas. Oh, you're listening, Hefner. I just thought you ought to know. Well, yes, we all know. Oh, here's another thing, too. It says one more little note on the bottom of the ad. It says, yes, this final resting place is permanently sheltered from nature's destructive forces by the finest granite and reinforced concrete. You will find peace of mind in the knowledge that your loved ones rest secure in the lasting protection of our garden mausoleum. Well, Charlie Simpson, I can just see him. He's a rock-bound, rotten sinner, yelling and hollering and belting the booze and falling down Saturday nights, fist-fighting at the office and screaming and hollering, pinching girls and all that. And finally, the lightning bolt hits Charlie and the family. Rest secure. Finally, great peace of mind in the knowledge that Charlie is at last secure. That great big chute opened up, and they could see those fiery flames, and Charlie is gone. Oh. Nature's forces are pretty destructive, all right. But of course, the thing what you got to remember about nature's forces, part of nature's forces, destructive elements. Nature's destructive force elements was Charlie himself. Is that ever? Oh, speaking of destruction, this is WOR, AM, and FMsville, New York. Now, there's another one here that I thought. One thing I must say, and it has to be said right here, that the medical fraternity. Have you ever known a doctor? Really known one? I don't mean Ben Casey. This is greasy kid stuff. I mean a doctor. And I'm talking about a really good one. I'm not talking about guys, you know, that fool around a little office and put the Band-Aids on and you know, give you the major wonder drugs every time you come up with a pip. You know, that kind of, there's a lot of, you know, we like to think that a guy's a doctor, automatically he's got it all. But yet, in every field, there are the chosen few. You know, there's a lot of sign painters, but there are a few Picassos. Believe me. And there's a lot of garage mechanics, but there are a few guys that can prepare and tune a car for Indianapolis. There's a big difference there. And yet they all know how to handle a wrench. You know, they can do something with the valves. So have you ever known a really great research physician? I mean, a guy that works in fantastically involved, far, way, way esoterically conceived life force investigations. Well, I've known a couple of those guys. I must say that I've been fortunate to know them. There's a funny look about the eye when you know them. If you think Ben Casey has a funny look, these guys really got a funny look. And yes, they do. They honestly do. They're given at times to be, they'll be sitting there without doing it. All of a sudden they'll laugh. And then, they'll just laugh. And you say, well, what was that? Fred, what was that? Oh. Nothing. How about another beer? Then you go along. You're worried, you know. I had this friend who he was such a famous research, medical research man. He was really doing research into the origins of life itself. You know, how it is, what makes it go. What makes babies, you know, really. You think you know? Forget it. Nobody knows yet. And, he was doing the research into this kind of stuff. Say, and the more he did research into this thing, the funnier he got. And the more he would, after long silences, He loved to play pool and stuff in the basement. He would be playing pool silently, and then as he racks them up, you'd hear the short laugh. Ha ha! And he would rack up another bunch, you see. And so instead of getting to be like Judge Hardy or Gene Herschel, like the kindly, friendly neighborhood practitioner, became truly subversive. The funny look in the eye, it began to develop. And this is the reason. Only if you read carefully medical journals will you find that peculiar sense of the irony that a doctor perceives when he really is working in forces that most of us ignore or completely leap over most of our lives. Very few people ever really ask themselves about the machinery of life. You know, they're so concerned with their little egos and their little idiosyncratic problems and concerns that the actual machinery, the motion, the activity, the great organization of life itself is a completely ignorable thing. I'm sure that by morning I'll be knee-deep in tracks again. Every time you talk of the great mysteries of life, there's this thing that comes, Mr. Shepherd, I heard you last night, and I, by George, I realized that once again, here was a young man who needed my message. If you will please take the good book. And oh boy, you know, it goes on and on. And this is another thing that causes many of these great research men to kind of, you know, there's a short ha. Well, nevertheless, this is an example. Do you have my gigantic British music there, Andy? Just my gigantic music? Because the British almost by nature have this, but when you get a British physician, you have something even going beyond it, you know? It's like applying sneakiness to sneakiness. Only a non-American culture could have produced Jonathan Swift. Jonathan Swift, believe me, does not come out of the same country, the same land, the same world, the same climate as Dale Carnegie. Two utterly, completely different worlds. Only another world could have produced John Knox. And we produced Norman Peel. Two completely different things. I mean, oh boy. Another world produces Kierkegaard. We produce Nick Kenny. We'll match Nick Kenny. It's just a different world. This is not to say one is better, one is worse. They're very different. Very different. So how would you like, yes, let's have tonight's.
The British Broadcasting Corporation, in connection with the British Medical Societies, present British Medicine on the March. Annals of British medicine go back many, many years. Medical men of British stripe have led research, have led the art of healing for ages past. And tonight, the BBC, in conjunction with its vast public service programming and its overseas services, once again salute the British medical man. Now tonight, as our salute to the British medical man, we quote from the British Medical Journal, the official organ of the British Medical Association. This is the issue for May 1963, page 1225. A quote from an anonymous doctor writing in an anonymous way in a British medical journal. Western psychiatric practices are not demonstrably superior in effectiveness to those of many native African healers or witch doctors, according to a Montreal psychiatrist who has spent more than 3 years studying mental illnesses and native healing practices in Nigeria. And there appears by the side of this statement a photograph of Montreal's Dr. Raymond Smith and Chief Jimo Andantona, King of the Nigerian Association of Medical Herbalists. I was pleased to find this confirmation, as a doctor, of my profound conviction that no doctor, however scientific, is any good as a healer unless he has quite a bit, in fact, quite a lot, of the witch doctor in him. Good people, the British. Great people. Truthful people, by God. Now we quote from Lancet, 4 May, 63, page 993. Lancet, an official British medical journal. In an article on medical practices in New Zealand by Sir Theodore Hawk. Although I saw a great many people in Australia, I was long in seeing a kangaroo. When I did, I was on a station in the outback where the roos were regarded with a certain affection, but also a certain desperation. Being, I was told, in quote, pest proportions. Ever since then, I have been wondering whether we ourselves are not assuming pest proportions in the British Isles. I mean, God, there'll always be an England.
Only an English medical man would looking out at a crowd of kangaroos running around in the veldt or in the outback desert, would parallel them with the British running around in the veldt of London and assuming pest proportions. Seriously, that's a British outlook. It's not an American outlook. You're walking down the street on Fifth Avenue. Have you ever felt that we are approaching now today in the world pest proportions? Look up the word pest. Really, seriously, look up the word pest. Does anyone have a dictionary out there? I'd like to know what the definition of pest is. I have a suspicion that pest is a fine description of mankind for today. Really. I suppose you have to define it from the standpoint of where you stand, literally, where you stand. If you're a corn borer, is a corn borer a pest because he's eating corn? I mean, what is his function but to eat corn? I mean, by definition, he's a corn borer. And yet we call him a pest. What's clicking here? There's something clicking here. Oh, that cheap red. Oh, we have a hotline. Where does that red one go? Oh, newsroom. But we have assumed in many ways pest proportions. You know, one of the very first times in my life that I had knowledge of that came upon a time when I'm a kid, see, and you know, kids, you know how when you're going on a date, kids going on dates are different from people in many ways. Have you had the feeling that many of the playwrights today are kids going on dates and they're scared? And so instead of eating a cake of yeast and going through with it, they write a play? And, no, really, there's some truth in that, you know. Many a guy chickened out after his first date and he became ascetic ever since that time. But, I remember one time, and it was just about this time of the year, you know, in the Midwest, nature is much closer than it is here, even though in many ways, physically, we are closer to many of the great forces, much closer to the great forces than they are there. The sea is here. On sun mornings, 5-6 o'clock in the morning, if you're running around town, if you happen to be up, you feel the sea in the air. You know then that New York is a sea city. It's a seaport. And you have to be up awful early because by 7 o'clock in the morning, it is just a place where a lot of cabs belch. You know, a lot of smoke rises, a lot of people push, and it ceases to be a seaport. But it really always remains that. However, as a kid, I grew up in northern Indiana, just on the edge of Chicago and the great bend of Lake Michigan that comes down around and sort of hangs like a great big fat overripe banana from whole thing of the Great Lakes. Well, summer comes with tremendous force there. Winter comes with even greater force. Spring is sublime in a place like that. Fall is sublime in a place where you have the great shifts and twists of nature. And so you're always aware of these things. It'll either be fantastically cold so that you can't ignore it, you know, Ed, like it's 27 below zero. Then you can't ignore it. There it is, you know, everything's frozen, your foot. And you can't run into an air-conditioned place or a place where it's heated and pretend it's not like that. Because you could, even the building cracks in the middle of winter. You can be in a place and you can just hear the building creaking because of the cold. In the summer, it's the same way. You can't escape even into air conditioning in the Midwest. There is always heat outside. And so about this time of the year, they begin to drift to the lake. Now, they're much less self-conscious about nature than we are. We here make a big deal about the beach, Fire Island, the whole thing. It's a whole kind of a mystique here, the beach wear and that whole business. You know, it's a big deal here. There are supplements in the Times about what to wear at the beach. There are articles about beach houses. There are whole communities of beach people, and certainly Chucky's one of those. There's this whole thing out there, you know, a guy after work gets in the back of the car, somebody drives the Oldsmobile, and they go down next to the Lux plant, and they swim. Somebody goes, you go swimming in the water, and it's just swimming, that's all. It's not a mystique or way of life. You go swimming, you come back. It's all part of life. It's not a separate incident. Well, about this time, just about the 4th of July, they go in great numbers, great hordes. Well, one week, I'm having one of the very first of the dates, and I remember this incident because it had to do with a girl that was very important. You always remember, and this is something I'm not sure women do. I'm very sure that men do. That men remain all of their lives very clearly, in a way involved, but they remain very, very, the memory is very clear of the first girl that they really got hung on. Isn't that true, Ann? As a kid, you remember that chick. And you carry it all of your life. No matter what happens, I was very involved, and I was really excited. It was a kind of wild excitement about going and seeing her, just seeing her, you know, knowing where her house was, you know what I mean? Just know, boy, there's a kind of wild, sick, funny thing goes on in your stomach, and you can't stay away. You run around in front of the house. You know, I used to go up and forth and back and forth in front of this house, riding first one foot on my bicycle handlebar and then the other foot. Then I'd crash through the hedge, and I'd get up and pull a sticker out, and of course, never knowing she's at the library. But it didn't make any difference. It was all symbolic and very real. Well, summertime came. I was 14 years old. And it was the time now to quit fooling around and go somewhere with a girl. Really go somewhere with a girl. Not go to a party, you know, where Esther Jane's having a party and everybody's there. But to actually go out with this girl. Well, where was I going to go? Well, I was going to take her to Chicago, to the beach. Well, now, that was the big beach. See, we had better beaches. That's the funny part of it. We had much better beaches all the way around, you know, all the way out to Gary and out to Miller and every place. But somehow, you were really going to the beach. If you went to Jackson Park in Chicago and went to the beach, that would be like if you lived on Fire Island or if you lived on some great beach, and when you really wanted to go to the beach, you went to Coney Island. You know, everybody got, it was a nutty, that's the way it was. So I was going to take her to Jackson Park, to the beach. Well, now Jackson Park Beach is crawling with humanity. It is a long, curving arc of a beach, but a big one. It's not little beaches. We have a lot of little beaches around here in New York. This is a big beach, you know. This beach ranges, it really goes all the way on up, I think, unbroken to Duluth. And if you continue to walk the way, if you go south, you'll wind up in the Straits of Mackinac. You know, it just keeps going up, you go right on up. Because all of Lake Michigan is like a giant beach. It really is. You never saw anything like it. It's not like the ocean here. It's a beach. Well, I take her to the Jackson Park Beach, and I'm in those days they had, I developed a terrible antipathy to bathing suits. Because they had woolen bathing suits. Do you remember when they had woolen trunks? They scratched, I'll tell you, it was like wearing about 45 Brillo pads in very strategic, awfully sensitive places, you know? Impossible. So I didn't know how to do that. It took me about 2 or 3 weeks to figure out how to invite her to the beach because I hated to go to the beach to begin with because of those bathing suits. When I went with Flick and all those guys, we would go at 3 o'clock in the morning in the Model A. We never worried about the suits. But this was official. See, I'm with the suit. And so I couldn't figure out whether to put the suit on before and wear it under my clothes, which would be sheer hell, obviously, or somehow tell her, you know, I'm taking the bathing suit in this little bag and then I'll put it on when I get there. You got it, see? So I decided to compromise. I decided what I was going to do was to wear my bathing suit there under my clothes, because it would be dry at least, you see. And then when I get there, after we have been swimming, I would go to the beach house and take off my bathing suit and put on my pants, and everything would be okay. Then we'd come home. I'd take her to this chicken rib place. It's a big, big, big place called Palm Grove Inn, where they serve rubber chicken. They had plastic fish and everything there. But it was the place the kids went, and they always would go there and get rum and Coca-Cola. That was a big thing, you know. The rum and Coca-Cola is a very racy thing. Oh, yes, made your eyeballs pop and your ears fly off. 14? Well, yeah, well, you see, that's what the kids in high school did. They were always drinking rum and Coca-Cola. They even had a song about it then. And, you know, everybody drank rum and Coca-Cola. And it was like a drink, just rum and Coca-Cola. It wasn't just, you never thought of it as liquor, you know. It was called liquor, drink, hard drink. It was rum and Coke. Yeah, rum and Coke. Well, anyway, here is when I first realized that we were approaching pest proportions, and it was a terrifying experience. We ride up on the bus all the way up to the south side of Chicago. We then transfer, go across town, go east on the bus, and finally we arrive out there by the lake. Well, there's the lake, and there are millions and millions of people all going across Jackson Boulevard. They're all crossing, going over. They're going across the outer drive. You can see them all going. Everybody's there, and there's a park there. And you look to the left, you look to the right, you look straight ahead, and there is a sea, a veritable Pacific Ocean of people, as far as the eye could see, and it's 4th of July. See, it's hotter than the fiends of hell are up there beating down the sun, and Dorothy and I go across the street there, and she's got this lovely blue bathing suit, you know, a kid bathing suit, you know what a kid bathing suit like, and it's a kid girl. So we go across, and we have a little basket that her mother, who is this Laplander, had fixed with the anise bread and all that, and it's a very, very polite, absolutely correct date. That the stuff which I understand happens at beaches now had not yet been discovered. What we did at beaches was go in the water and holler and throw a beach ball back and forth, you know, that kind of stuff. See, so we get down on the beach, yeah, and we're playing, see, and the sun is beating down, and my bathing suit is starting to itch. We go in the water a couple of minutes, and I come back, and the sun's, so I kept going in the water trying to keep the thing wet, and it's itchy, and it's going all out of my skull. I'm just going nutty. I have a real thing about itchy bathing suits. And itchy suits to this very day. So, oh boy, this bathing suit was good. And it was wild. And the bathing suit was my pride and joy on top of it, but I hated it, and I loved it at the same time. It was gold colored. Yes, it was a yellow gold wool bathing suit that had this little Jansen thing on the side, you know, with the guy diving in and all. It was very racy, but oh boy. I'm telling you, if you can imagine dynamic, live, living sandpaper, that's what this bathing suit was. And it was itching every place, and it was moving and crawling all over me and grabbing me and tickling me. And it was tweaking me, and it was doing everything. It was chafing me, and it was everything. And I would lie on this little thing. And on top of that, you see, there's another thing that happens. When you're with a girl, and you're very involved, you know, you're just so thrilled and everything to be with this chick that your skin is open, everything. Are you aware that you're much more allergic to pips and all kinds of, you know, there are some people who break out in rashes just by going on a date. Well, up to a lesser or a greater degree, we are all doing that. So there I am. My skin is open. My pores are open. I'm kind of sweating because I'm next to Dorothy. I'm afraid I'm going to say the wrong thing. And my bathing suit has taken absolutely rotten advantage of it. It is going to work like a fiend on me. Ever since that time, I can't stand the name Jansen. I mean, Jansen makes me sweat. So this thing is going. Oh, boy, it's going. And so I'm laying there, and I'm hopping around on the blanket, and Dorothy is looking out over the sun. The sun has come down. And she keeps saying, well, what's the matter with you? Well, there were a lot of things the matter with me. Several of them I can't even discuss on the air. But one of the things was this bathing suit, this nutty, rotten bathing suit, which was contributing to it. So I'm going back and forth, and the crowd is getting bigger and bigger, and now it is about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. There must have been 2.5 billion people there. You know the kind where they take the picture, and the next day it says record crowd, breaks all records at Jackson Park Beach, 4,700 drowned, not even noticed. You know that kind of thing? Well, yeah, oh yeah, it's fantastic. People are passing out because of the heat, and guys are, fist fights are breaking out, and people are throwing bananas at each other, and we're sweating, and I'm laying on there, and the bathing suit is really working on me. Well, I can see way off in the distance, about 4 miles away, this little brick house. Well, I have found out by the lifeguard has told me that that is the bathing place, the little beach house where you go, the dressing room. Well, finally the time comes, and Dorothy says, "What's the matter with you? What's with you? What's the matter with you?" She, you know, and so I give her to indicate that I have a very urgent mission. That my urgent mission is that I have decided to surprise her, and I'm going to get 2-foot-long hot dogs. They had a hot dog stand down by the beach house that specialized in foot-long hot dogs. You don't have those out here. They had foot-long hot dogs, and they put a flag on them. Well, it was a foot-long hot dog. So I said, "How would you like a foot-long hot dog?" And she says, "Well, that would be nice. We have eaten 9 sandwiches apiece, you see, provided by this mother." And so we're sitting there, both our pots are hanging out there, and we're kind of sick and feeling crummy. But a foot-long hot dog is something that is not really food. It's, you know, it's part of being at the beach. So I said, "Well, I'm going." What I really was going to do was to go down there, take off that rotten bathing suit, put on my slacks, and come back looking cool and casual, and therefore be under control of the situation. So I start out. I go all the way back to the beach house. Remember, it's about 2 miles. I get to the beach house. It must be like approaching an oasis when you've been in the desert for 100 years. The last 500 feet, I bet I broke 7 records. I ran like insane to get in there, to get that crummy thing off. And I got in, and I'm taking it off, and I just, I take it off, and I throw it down. Oh, boy. And I'm still wet, and I'm drying myself. Oh, what a great feeling when you get that thing off. It's just, you feel like a new kid. Well, I take this thing off, and I pull on my sheen. You know, I got the slacks. I put on my slacks, and I take that crummy bathing suit, and I wrap it up in my towel. Oh, boy. And I look at some chicks that are there, and I'm looking and walking around. I get a drink of water, and, you know, I do all the necessary stuff, and I go out. I go to the foot-long hot dog guy, and I spring for 2-foot-long hot dogs, which were 20 cents apiece with the mustard and the flag. And this is my real... I have no interest, really, in a foot-long hot dog now. I feel so good that anything is great. Well, I get these 2-foot-long hot dogs, and I start going back. Would you know it? I could not find where she was. Well, I start coming back, and I didn't realize it at first. I came back like about a mile, and beach, when you're really, you know, you think you know the part of the beach, but the beach is the beach is the beach. It's nature. It's all one long piece of water and sand. And I had done, you see, I had taken a sight line on a fat lady sitting next to a watermelon. And you know, and somebody had up a little net where they were playing volleyball or something. I did not realize there were over 17,000 volleyball nets up. And there were over 2,500 fat ladies sitting next to watermelons. And the same lake. Well, I came back, and I got about a mile back, and I'm carrying these 2 hot dogs, and I'm beginning to realize that I don't know where I am. Especially when I saw the steel mills coming up. I have now walked over like my maybe 25 miles. See, I'm approaching the Michigan border now. Well, I turn around and I start going back towards Wisconsin. Well, I move back. Now I'm on the near north side, you see, and I'm rapidly getting near Milwaukee. And I have not seen this chick, and it is getting vaguely dark. I have 2 ice-cold foot-long hot dogs with the flags at half-mast. And I'm walking now. I turn back and I start going back, and now I'm getting really panicky. I am really getting panicky because I see people packing up baskets, you know, and they're packing up things and they're putting up the things and they get ready to go and like that. It is now about 7 o'clock. We were supposed to be on the bus roughly 6:30 so that we could be home before dark. Be home before dark. Well, it's now about 7, you know, and it's beginning to get dark. It is now 7:15. It is now 7:30. It is now 7:45. It is now really getting dark, and I can see little bonfires, you know, fires are lighting up. People are starting with the hot dog routine, and an entirely new crew is coming on the beach. This is the crew that I knew nothing about, you know, five, oh, guys, you can hear bottles rattling and chicks screaming and hollering. I kept stepping on people under blankets for the first time as some wild things were happening, and all the while I'm still walking around with these 2 petrified hot dogs. Well, to make a long story short, a cop comes along the beach and says, "Hey, come here, kid." And I came over. "So you're looking for somebody named Dorothy?" She is now in the police station, which was down at the other end of the beach somewhere. She is reported to be missing. I have drowned. Well, I arrive at the... And she's sitting there. She's crying. And cops are sitting around. I got two hot dogs. And she says, where were you? Well, a kid doesn't say I got lost. I said, what do you mean, where was I? I was looking for you. Where were you? And she says, I was on the blanket. I said, well, you must have moved the blanket. She said, no, I didn't move the blanket. I was on the blanket, and this man came over, and, terrible visions, you know, explaining this to father, mother, back at home. I got the two hot dogs. I said, let's go. Well, she put on her thing, her little coat. We rushed across the street. We got into the streetcar, went over to the bus terminal, got on the bus, and all the way home, she's crying. I said, Dorothy, don't cry. Don't cry, Dorothy. Please don't cry. Don't say anything. And then finally, about 25 blocks from home, she calmed down. And this is when I began to realize the true perfidy of women. She looks me right in the eye, and she says, I'll tell you what we'll do. I'll tell them I was visiting Joan. She was going to lie. She said, I'll tell them I was visiting Joan. I says, well, okay. And 20 minutes later, we're there. She carried it off beautifully. Somehow, I suspect she liked the idea of that man coming up in the dark. She liked the police. She liked crying, even. Yes, there are speaking of primeval forces, get out of the way then, will you? We have with us Mandarin House, deep and sinister, touching upon the basic carnivore that you are. If you've never tried Mandarin food, I would like to recommend Mandarin House, 13th Street, between 6th and 7th, in the heart of the village. Go down there some night in the dark of the moon when the village is festering. They've got a bar. When that air conditioning is throbbing, and when outside you can feel the veritable pulse of man roaring, rushing red blood through that arterial canal of existence. Mandarin food, yes. You know, there are, in some places, Mandarin food is classified as a sin. So I would suggest, if you really want to try it, Mandarin House in the village between 6th and 7th on 13th Street. Oh, speaking of sins, tomorrow night's program will be a seminar on sin. For those of you who have felt that you've been laggard or lax in certain areas of your artistic life, listen tomorrow night. We've got several goodies in preparation for you. As a matter of fact, you just come back tomorrow night. Things are working out okay. Working out all right. Just don't panic.